Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name is Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Tony Evans of the Evening Standard and Seb Stafford-Bloor, editor of Tifo Football. The international break. Time to draw breath. We'll get into England issues later, but it's the perfect time to look at the balance of power in the domestic game. Liverpool lead the Premier League by 2 points, but the quadruple is still on for Manchester City. Who's in best shape, Tony?
Well, I think City, clearly. I mean, the next round of games after the international break, City go to Fulham and Liverpool play Tottenham at home. And clearly, Liverpool made hard work of Fulham, but they got the results. I can't see City struggling at all with them. But Tottenham, who've had a really bad month, had a break, time to regroup, and they're going to come to Anfield desperate to get something there, and they need it. So I'd say City, definitely. However, you know, you when you're top of the league, coming to the end of March, and you've got the points in the bag, you'd rather have that than the game in hand.
Yeah. If you look at those last seven fixtures, Seb, Liverpool only dropped 1 point in the corresponding fixtures. Now, the pressure points, Chelsea maybe.
Yeah.
Wolves' last game of the season?
Yeah, definitely.
How do you see them faring?
I think they'll be OK. I mean, the one thing I'd add in, Mike, is that obviously City have got that double header in the Champions League against Spurs. I'm not expecting them to come through that. But typically and traditionally, those European games featuring domestic sides, they're a bit of a war. So a bit attritional. They've got Spurs in between that as well. I think it's 3 games in 10 days. So we'll see. I mean, see how City come out of that. See which players come out of that as well. I mean, I still really like Liverpool. I mean, City deserves to be considered slight favourites, but people are being very negative about Liverpool for no reason. They look they're looking very, very good shape.
I want to ask Tony this question. But if you look at, you know, I'm nonplussed by the sort of perception that people don't want Liverpool to win the league.
Yeah. Mike, you know what? The tribalism is so thick nowadays, sort of viscous thick rather than stupid thick. I think it's just something to rage against. I mean, I try my best to kind of tune a lot of this stuff out, but I think given what City are and given what in the abstract they represent to some people, I think it's also important for the league to have a strong Liverpool, and I think it would make a really nice, refreshing change. They're not a pauper club by any stretch of the imagination, but I think for the sake of difference and for the sake of mutual interest, I think it's important that other clubs at least contend in title races. I don't really have a horse in that race, really, but I don't really understand that.
I think people have got short memories, really. And, you know, we're in a different age of social media and all that. But when Manchester United went through their long title drought, you know, the 26 years, and they were vying to win, you know, the league, like, the clamour, the press was very similar. And whenever a big club has gone a long time without winning something, it's going to be like that. And the reaction from opposing fans was very similar as well. It's going to happen. If we go another, decade without Arsenal winning the league, and Arsenal suddenly put in a challenge, the same thing will happen. So I think there is an added level of anti-scousness which just exists in this country anyway, you know, but which we expect. But I think most of it's just the fact that when a big club is on the verge of some sort of success after a long drought, then there's going to be massive publicity and people are going to respond negatively to that publicity.
Obviously, it's a club you know exceedingly well. Is it a more mature club these days in terms of we don't see them or we don't expect them to sell either through the unfulfilled ambition of a couple of players or more money elsewhere, you know, Suarez, Sterling, Coutinho. Is the club a much more rounded club now?
Well, yeah, and I think the most important thing, they've got the best manager they can get, so he's in place, and I think that makes a huge difference. The way it's run, there are still dysfunctions there that make it difficult in some areas. But, yeah, getting a proper manager in and having a proper strategy going forward, it helps an awful lot. When you look at how badly the whole Sterling mess was handled, you know, they've come a long way since then. As I say, that's a lot to do with the manager.
It's interesting, you know, listening to Klopp very recently talking about we're only in the early stages of this project. Yeah. He's a long-term manager in a short-term business, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a dynastic manager. He's one of the kind of the neophytes that believes in the project. I know people sneer at that word, but that's the sense that you get from him, that he kind of, I think it's reflected also in Liverpool's transfer activity last summer. With the goalkeeper accepted, you brought in two midfielders for a lot of money who have been introduced gently throughout the season. And they seem to me like, especially Keita, they seem to me to be signings aimed at five-year periods. So you bring him in, you don't dump him in your midfield and say, right, well, we're gonna hang our hat on whether you swim or not in this division. We're going to see what you do over 3 years, 4 years. And obviously that's tied to Klopp. And I think it's refreshing. I mean, this is also an age of Marco Silvas, where you see people that kind of jump from profession to profession to profession, and they don't seem to leave much there. I mean, maybe in 3 years' time, we're still talking about Marcus Silva, the Everton manager, maybe. Yeah. But at the moment, it's like you're in employment to seek employment elsewhere. And I think it's really refreshing. I mean, Klopp, but Pochettino too, is another one who's altered the culture rather than just the first 11. And that's I think, certainly what traditional football fans who aren't kind of enslaved to the primacy of the transfer market want to see.
Mm. I think it's interesting that we're 3.5 years into the Klopp project. I think that as great as Nach is, there's still a sense that it's fresh and new.
Yeah.
Which is great, but it's only going so far. So, I mean, I think reaching the point where, you know, when progression needs to stop and deliver.
What lessons do you think he's learned about the nature of the club?
I think he understood a lot about the club and the, you know, the sort of connection with the fans and the soul of the club and all that. I think he's learned that the owners have always been enthralled to him. You know, he's certainly learned how to work them. I think he's learned that the recruitment process isn't perfect. So where he has to do at times is step in and say, no, this is who I want. And what he's done is he's got the ability to get them to pay big money for players he thinks will make a big difference. And they have. I mean, you know, Van Dijk, you know, 75 million. I mean, I thought 75 million was a lot for a centre-half. But, you know, worth every penny to the club. You know, Alisson, the same. So he's learnt that. He's learnt you can't, basically, you can't let the number crunches in the with the computers do all the recruitment.
They spent a lot of money last summer. We're in that inevitable phase where they're going to be linked with players. Yeah. You know, the latest one is Ferro. Benfica defender, only 10 senior games, 21 years old. Hey, presto, he's an £85 million transfer target.
Yeah.
Well, we can put that maybe to one side. Yeah. But do you expect them to strengthen in the summer? And where, Seb?
It's hard to know where, Mike. I mean, certainly within the first team, I think they need another centre-half. But I don't see... There's no one in that first 11 that needs immediate replacing. In fact, I'd hope that they'd allow the summer... Maybe bring in sort of a slightly different profile of player to exist underneath the first team. But you'd allow some of these newer parts to mature a little bit. Keita, Fabinho, of course. And also, you've got players on that side who are not anywhere close to their prime. Someone like Alexander-Arnold. I still think Andrew Robertson has a level above where he is at the moment. Terrific player, though, he is. And, you know, just allow... Liverpool seem to depend on chemistry. So surely, when that's the case, you allow as much time as possible for that to grow, especially in the sort of the attacking three and in midfield. So I don't think there's much to do. They will be linked, but that's the digital game, isn't it, really? But I don't expect anything like last summer.
the same?
I think something needs to happen in that midfield. I mean, I'm now entirely convinced that the business in the midfield he did last summer was good business. Keita is all the players rave about him in training, he's great in training. It's not coming out on the pitch, and that to me is always a bad sign. So to, you know, they used to say similar stuff about Stuart Downing.
Tony, where do you think his best position is, Keita? At Liverpool rather than previously?
Well, I'm not entirely sure he suits a midfield three. No. I think that's one of the problems. I think because he doesn't have the ability to release as often in a three. And the thing is, he hasn't the work rate that you'd need to do that sort of job. And Klopp's clearly tied to this 4-3-3. Get players who suit it more. Again, Fabinho, I'm not so sure about his mobility. Great when he's on the ball. And the other thing that worries me, when he's on the ball, he's great, but he doesn't have that snap to the ball you need in the Premier League.
Yeah, that's
compete for the first ball, win the second ball. Mm-hmm. He's not a second ball winner, and that will hold him back. Both of them, you feel, have mobility problems that the opposition can pass around them and go through them quick. So I think Klopp needs to reassess where he's got in midfield. And he's got a platoon of players, all of whom are good, but he hasn't got the right blend, and he needs to find a way of getting the right blend, and I suspect he'll need to bring someone in to get that.
Mm. By common consent, they've got a favourable draw in the Champions League, Porto. Mm. There's an obvious danger in looking too far ahead. However, I've got a question from one of the listeners, Sammy. With the Champions League draw already done in the brackets formula, what do you guys think will be the final? City-Liverpool, anyone?
Yeah, I would never discount Barcelona. Right. If Barcelona get past Manchester United, which I expect them to do, they're a problem just because they have so many players who have been in that part of the competition so many times before. And it's one of those intangibles, which is very difficult to price. But any time Leo Messi's on a pitch, I don't think I would want to bet against him. I expect Man City to get through the other part of the draw. I think they'll beat Spurs. I don't think they'll have a... I expect Juventus to get past Ajax, and I don't expect City to have any problems with Juventus, despite the Ronaldo factor and all that. City, Barcelona / Liverpool. Let's put it that way.
You know, it's hard not to say Barcelona, except for one thing. Liverpool always win in the Nou Camp. Always knock Barcelona out. So, you know, it's... I think Barcelona are clearly the favourites in that side. I think Juventus would be more difficult than City perhaps think. I mean, there's a lot of gamecraft there, a lot of nous, which City don't really have. And I could see it being a Barcelona-Juventus final.
Really? And in that case, Messi, you know, you mentioned him already. Mm-hmm. You know, let's dwell for a second on that performance in Sunday against Betis. He's the sort of player who still manages to turn you into a 10-year-old kid, isn't he? It's fantastic.
For sure. I mean, one thing I'll say about that goal is, for my money, Frank Lampard scored a very similar goal against Hull probably about 10 years ago now, on his wrong foot, from an identical angle. So if people have forgotten about that, then go to YouTube. Yeah, he is. Barcelona are not what they were. I mean, they are not the cohesive force they once were, and they've got a few problems. They've got issues in midfield. The third spoke on that Suarez-Messi axis is a little bit tenuous at the moment too. And, you know, Samuel Umtiti missing from the defence is a problem. But Messi, he's one of those players that sort of, he has that quality whenever he gets the ball, as an opposing fan, you think he can hurt you. It scares you. So Ronaldo had that, original Ronaldo and the newer one. Thierry Henry had that as well when he was in the Premier League in his prime. Messi at a level above. Every time he touches the ball, you're afraid. And that's an amazing mark of respect when you're able to say that. He's still a fabulous player.
I saw a Manchester United fan on Twitter refer to him as the little Maradona. I thought, well, good luck with that.
Other supermarkets are available. City, they're punishing poor teams at the moment, you know, Schalke being a case in point. And then they're struggling a little to actually get over the line in recent games. Is that a good or a bad thing?
Well, I think, you know, title-winning teams grind out results when they're not at the best. So, in a sense, it's a good thing. I think it'll probably be a bad thing once you get into the Champions League quarterfinals and semis. I think Tottenham are going to be a far more difficult proposition for City than most people think. And I'm not entirely sure it's a given that City are going to go through. So I think they're going to have to be at the top of the game for that tie. And whoever they play in the semis, in the league, they can probably play badly and still win. You know, it's, I can't see many teams taking much off them, but certainly it's one of the things we've seen, and you know, we've seen from PSG, you know, we've seen from Bayern Munich. You can beat the teams in your own league. It's great, it's easy, but then when you play with the big boys, you've got to turn it up a notch. And if City are not anywhere near the best, then they'll struggle in Europe again.
I suppose, you know, this break is going to be important. But getting players back, you know, Liverpool with Joe Gomez, that we're told he's going to come back after the break. Similarly with City and Kevin De Bruyne, he's absolutely key for them, isn't he?
I think so. I think it's a little bit too neat, but I think one of the reasons behind them being a level just below where they were last season is De Bruyne, because they've twice tried to bring him back. The first time too soon and it showed. The second time it worked better, but he was unlucky again. I don't know, he's a Swiss Army knife of football. He hurts you in so many different ways that I don't know, as an opposing manager, how you plan against that, how you build your team around stopping him. And if you do, if you overcommit to doing that, there are so many other parts of that side which hurt you too. Fullbacks and you know, players like, you know, forgetting David Silva and Sané and Aguero, you've also got that sort of power from Kyle Walker at the back, which I think is a really underrated part of what they do well. It's just the ability to penetrate from deep. So they're a nightmare. If you add De Bruyne in on top of that, they are, when they play well, when it clicks, they're almost unbeatable. Certainly, Tony mentioned Spurs. I mean, I want to sign up to that. I want to sign up to all of that faith. That's one of the big differences, is that you have players in Tottenham's side who, they're good players, some of them are very good, but you know how they're going to play. You don't have the kind of the diverse impact that a De Bruyne brings, and that's what makes him a rare player. It's not any one attribute, it's not any one thing that he does well, it's that whole range. And you don't know how he's going to disrupt a game and change it. It's very, very difficult. So if he's fit, they deserve to be a Champions League favourite, certainly.
Yeah, it's interesting that Pep himself has finally come out and said, look, yeah, my time at City will be defined by whether we win the Champions League or not. Understand that?
Oh, yeah. That's exactly what he was brought in for. I mean, you know, this is the centre of Abu Dhabi. Is they want to be a European power, a global power. They want to be up there at the top table. And if he doesn't achieve that, for all the titles he'll win, it will be a disappointment. And, I mean, that's another plus for Liverpool. The focus of City is on, out of the four trophies they're in, is on the Champions League. And that, again, might have, there's an awareness in the dressing room with that as well, and the pressure will be building there. So, I mean, I'm not so sure. Well, I think it's good that he's admitted it in public. I think that will, in some ways, lift some of the pressure, but in other ways, it turns it up a notch.
Talking of pressure, when does the increasing concentration on the quadruple become really oppressive?
If they drop points, if there's an unhelpful draw here or a kind of a inconvenient away goal somewhere in the Champions League, then people start to talk about it. And when they start to talk about it, players don't exist in a vacuum. They never can do, and Guardiola doesn't either. So as soon as it becomes part of the conversation, as soon as their identity changes from this sort of this irresistible force, which is going to sweep past absolutely everyone. I mean, I thought Chris Hughton's reaction to the FA Cup draw was very telling yesterday. It's like, okay, well, we'll just, I know he won't.
I really felt for him.
Because me too.
Was really honest, wasn't he?
Yeah, me too. And I really like Chris Hughton. I think he's one of the best people in the game, actually, as a human being. But it's very telling that is the sort of the public's reaction to them. So at the moment, City have this kind of this invulnerability. But as soon as, a couple of results change, there's a nervousness here or there, as soon as people talk about it, then it becomes part of the news cycle, and that's probably when the pressure comes.
I'm surprised that it hasn't reached
a
crescendo yet. I mean, because normally, and I'm not exempting myself from this here, but the British media are slightly hysterical in the, in the way they project how the season will go.
They did this last year in October.
Exactly. I think it's been a very restrained reaction far, which is the right way because, all right, they've got one in the bag, but winning four trophies, it just doesn't happen. You know, it's not in England. And you know, even when United did the treble, so many things had to fall into place for them. Yeah. So many good sides had to, you know, basically surrender to them. Mm. You know, Bayern Munich.
Arsenal in that semi-final.
Yeah, Arsenal in the semi, you know, it's Liverpool in the third round of the Cup.
Yeah.
You know, and there was an awful lot of, don't get me wrong, good sides, and they kept going at it all the time. But, you know, under normal circumstances, at least one of those games would have seen United get beaten.
Mm. Good side. Are they almost too good for their own good in the sense that if they do win, let's say even three, people just look at this and think, we need someone else.
Yeah, it's a funny one, Mike. I almost don't want to answer that, just because I think a lot of this has to do with the accusations which are currently sort of City in their all three dimensions, because it's not a football team in the truest sense at the moment. It's it's an enterprise. It's a content producer.
And also, you know, for the record, obviously, you know, those allegations about financial misconduct, you know, they are very hotly and strenuously and consistently denied.
Absolutely. I think the difficulty is that people will believe what they want to believe. And we may find City are completely innocent, but the average fan who is still sort of, who is reading the reports in Der Spiegel, who has their own biases, it's very easy as a fan of another club to explain away your own team's failings with sort of unfounded accusations or the belief that someone, the only way a rival could overcome you is by wrongdoing. That's convenient for a fan, so people will choose what they want to believe. Mm. At the moment it's unproven, it's just conjecture.
It's interesting, Tony, you say you give Spurs more than a squeak. They've got a very long break, is it 3 weeks?
Yeah.
What would you like to see Pochettino do within those 3 weeks? What are his priorities?
Well, I mean, I think getting players fit, putting some confidence back into them. One of the things we've seen with Tottenham during the Pochettino era, and also with Liverpool, to be fair, is the sides have faded in the last part of the season. And it's in part, I think, due to the rigorous training that they've done in the early part of the season. They've run out of steam. And in part, psychological. And so what he's going to do is perhaps rest them up, get them fit and get their minds right, get them to believe that they can kick on in this part of the season where, you know, we've seen them self-destruct. So, you know, this is not the time for self-destruction. This is one of the biggest tests of Pochettino's management, and we'll see exactly how good he is, because suddenly, from being title contenders in a matter of, 3 weeks, they're looking over the shoulder at the
others. And out of both cups as well, within the space of
all. And they're looking over the shoulder at teams that have frankly been pretty poor this season.
Yeah, what was the mood amongst Spurs fans? Was it sort of, oh, here we go again?
Yeah, but that's muscle memory, Mike. It always will be, I'm afraid. I hate to say it. I think there's a couple of frustrations, and they've kind of reached critical mass. The stadium, I know we have a date to move in. The stadium has annoyed a lot of people, and rightly so, because trawling to Wembley every other week has not been great for fans. Also, this sort of continuous... You've had the issues with the transfer budget. So on the one hand, the club always says, right, well, these funds are ring-fenced and, you know, whatever happens to the stadium doesn't affect it. And then on the other, you have these obvious needs in the team which aren't addressed. Spurs, Tony's absolutely right. You know, this is a test of Pochettino's emotional management, but that team's got big structural issues. It needs at least two new fullbacks. They've been working without an orthodox central midfielder for quite some time. They've had to deal without Kane and without a proper, not just a replacement in Fernando Llorente, but a player that allows them to play in the same way. I mean, it's all kinds of issues. And so you've had this drag fatigue. You've had the footballing equivalent of having to live out of a hotel for a year and a half in bags. And you've just had this surrounding uncertainty about the manager as well. I mean, it's not so long ago. I know everything has changed now, but you couldn't watch a game that Tottenham were playing in without a good half an hour of it being dedicated to as and when Pochettino is going to be Manchester United manager. These things are difficult.
Two more defeats for Solskjaer and starts again.
Maybe exactly that. So maybe when you recover, maybe, you know, say they go to Anfield and win or take a point, which would be a very good result. They go to City and win. And in the meantime, if Solskjaer is not returning to the form prior to Paris Saint-Germain, then that begins again. So Tottenham are battling a lot of different things, not just their own history, but that will always be part of it. That will always be on a fan's mind, of course.
You know, Daniel Levy has had a meeting with the Supporters Trust, in which he he said, look, we're in the stadium, and we start on April the 3rd against Crystal Palace. The transfer budget will remain untouched. Is Pochettino justified in asking precisely what transfer budget?
Yeah, I was going to say it remains untouched last summer and then January. Yeah. I mean, how much longer is it going to remain untouched? About touching everything and spending it? Yeah, I mean, if I was... Pochettino is very unhappy with the situation. You know, you'd be snarling. You know, it's the squad needs a bit more depth. It needs a freshening up. And, you know, the failure to do that, you know, may well cost Tottenham dear.
Yeah, no, I can't. Absolutely.
Because he's a good soldier, isn't he, Pochettino? He won't win
straight back. He's not a guy that's going to cause internal issues by sort of mouthing off in press conferences. He's not Jose Mourinho. Mm. I'll go on one of those rants again, Mike, where I just burst into tears at the end of it. So let's move on to something else.
I mean, you know, it sends a message to future employers. I'm a good boy. I won't rock the boat in public.
Yeah. You know, let's sort of stretch the imagination somewhat and suggest that you're in the shoes of Ed Woodward, Tony. Mm. Would you give Solskjaer the job?
No. I think that would be a massive mistake. I think the parallels with Di Matteo are quite clear. And what I'd be doing is I'd be looking and saying to myself, who's going to be the manager of Manchester United for the next 5 years? Who is someone we can go forwards with who can build this club? And you know what? You might come to the conclusion that Solskjaer, you'd have to wait till the end of the season. The reality is, I don't think it is. There's a lot of good players at United. It's not the most balanced squad you've ever seen. But good players sometimes, when they're released from an oppressive manager, get things done on their own. And sometimes, even with managers, they change things. I mean, Harry Redknapp's a classic example. Yep. You know, you've seen him at Tottenham. You know, 20 minutes into a game, Tottenham had looked very different in shape to how Harry sent them out. Because, you know, they'd work it out themselves. And United's players have done that. But that'll only take you so far. And it certainly won't... Once you come up against really good teams, you need someone who can basically give you the strategy and tactics that'll get you through, you know, sort of which will cover up your vulnerable spots and will accentuate your strengths. And what we've seen over the last couple of weeks, and I think certainly against Wolves, is Solskjaer's inability to manage the game, to make changes, to shift the point of attack and to, you know, strengthen areas where they're coming under pressure. So I think I'd look for someone with a bit more experience and better credentials. Mm.
But hasn't he earned the right to try and reboot this? And look, we're in an age of overreaction. They've lost two games. That happens.
Yeah, I think he has on the right. I think what might be important here is the amount of political capital Ed Woodward has to play with, because it's very, very difficult not to give him the job. Mm. I agree with Tony completely. I think it reeks of the Di Matteos. Like, it's that situation again where you just think, well, it's not that we're in a position to discount what he's done. It's just that no one really knows what he is, because that freeing power that a new manager has is very, very real. But I think what happens, for instance, if Woodward says, right, well, we are going to go down the experience route, we're going to bring in a high priest of European football, which usually means a six-month adjustment period. Mm. So every Man United fan is going to be coming off a season which has been relatively successful in comparison to what it could have been, and then they're going to go back into transience, essentially flux. And that's going to be very difficult for Woodward to manage whilst that comes good, with the knowledge that Solskjaer is out floating again at Mould or wherever he's gone to. Mm. That's a hard sell, I think, as logical as it would be.
While we're talking about potential managerial change, Tony, Chelsea, are we just waiting for the politics to play out?
Without a doubt. I think Sarri's era there is coming to an end. It's an unmanageable club. I mean, right from the first time they got rid of Mourinho back in 2007, they've downgraded the position of manager, and they've felt it was an interchangeable role. Anyone could do it. You know, if you've got the right players, anyone can manage. We're seeing the illogical conclusion of that idea, and the players have become accustomed to not playing for the managers, because they understand the manager's got little power as well. With the transfer ban, you know, it's unless it gets overturned, which I think it probably will ultimately. But even so, it make you when you were coming in, if you were coming into the club, you'd think to yourself, do I really want this job? You look at the people that chewed up and spat out, And what manager would go there? What manager whose career is on an upward trajectory would go there?
Yeah, I agree.
I can't think of one.
I noticed, said that Tom Ricketts, who's the owner of the Chicago Cubs, was at the Chelsea Wolves game. There has been talk in the States about them wanting to get into the Premier League. Are we looking at a new suitor? And can you envisage a club or Chelsea without Abramovich?
Well, absolutely, because I think the era of the Abramovich figure is coming to an end in the sense that it's not enough just to be a billionaire. You have to be not only a billionaire, but a billionaire with a plan and the resources to enact that plan. You can't exist now as a wealthy club who make mistakes, accept they're going to make mistakes, and then try and buy your way out of those mistakes, whether that be with new players or redundancy payments. Ricketts is really interesting because he's his time at Chicago Cubs, obviously he delivered the World Series, which is, you know, sort of gives him win some affection in the city itself. But he was also very adept at kind of manoeuvring around the sort of the situation around Wrigley Field with the construction of kind of facilities for the community as well, which it's a little bit of a it's a bit of a leap. But if you think about the situation at Chelsea too, and the trouble they've had in that area and the need for expansion, there's a synergy there certainly. But I think you need to. What he seems to represent is ownership in a three-dimensional sense, like someone that is kind of is going to be a little bit more visible, but has a strategy beyond writing checks, which I think has been, once upon a time, wasn't a problem for Chelsea, but is becoming progressively more so as time goes on.
I think the sort of figures that have been bandied round for the value of Chelsea are pretty unrealistic, you know, more than $2 billion. And I don't see...
With that stadium to construct as well.
I think... The Americans, when they've come into the league, have been very astute in the prices they've paid. So, I mean, I think Chelsea's overpriced.
Mm. Realistically, is Chelsea's best chance of getting into the Champions League, the Europa League? They've got Slavia Prague, and then they're facing the winners of Benfica, Eintracht Frankfurt. That looks doable, doesn't it?
It does. I put a caveat in there, Mike. That pitch out in Slavia Prague is horrible. I saw their game against Sevilla on Thursday night, and they're a good side, but it's like playing a rugby pitch. So they want to be careful with putting all their eggs in that basket. I don't think they're out of the top four race, just because I think the teams behind Liverpool and Man City are dropping points all over the place. So I don't think they can sign that off. And Eintracht Frankfurt, a good team too. They handled Inter Milan very, very comfortably in the second leg there. So the way Chelsea are playing, I don't think that their path is that easy.
Arsenal have got Napoli, second leg, away from home. Interesting developments yesterday with Munchi, who was expected to go to Arsenal as sporting director, opted to go back to Sevilla. How much of a blow was that to Emery?
I think it's a serious blow, really, because obviously they had a relationship and it was a suit them. And Munchie's record is, perhaps it's a bit exaggerated, but still a good record. And, you know, Arsenal changed the recruitment and then, they've lost their head of recruitment, so they need to fill that. I mean, the way Arsenal do things, you have to buy in the analytics company and using, the stats. And Wenger was very, very against a lot of the signings. They need to sort themselves out. In some ways, Emery's done better than I expected this year, because I expected to be a bigger meltdown once Wenger left, and a Manchester United-style meltdown. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly they need to get... I mean, they've lost... The Wenger year ended, and immediately Gazidis leaves. You know, before the year's out, you've lost your head of recruitment. You know, something's not quite right there. They need to sort something out. And generally, a well-run club manifests itself on the pitch. What's going on in the boardroom manifests itself on the pitch. And I think that the same thing will happen to Arsenal if it continues to be such a vacuum there.
Let's look at the FA Cup. Great platform now for Wolves and Watford, obviously, play one another in the semi. They're clubs on a similar trajectory, aren't they?
Absolutely. They're the two most progressive sides in the league at the moment. Wolves, I think, is just a great story waiting to happen. Spent a little time at Molineux this season, and there's just this great enthusiasm for what the team is. And also, I mean, they're a good side. Plus, of course, when summer arrives, they've got the resources to become an excellent one. Do you imagine, I don't want to pick any players out because they've done so well this season, but if you added a £50 million centre-forward into that side, another centre-half possibly, another midfielder to go with, three that are pretty decent as it is, they are credibly a top four threat. Maybe an outsider for it, but a threat, someone to be taken seriously. And Watford, you know, Watford have done excellently, and also they have the support of probably one of the most intelligent scouting networks in football at the moment. And by all account, I'm no expert on Spanish football. There's a couple of Cucho Hernandez Martinez.
He's very, very good. He
I read about him in your book, actually. Yes,
yes. They're talking about him as a new Aguero.
Right. So and that piques my interest, certainly. So if you add these players into those teams and you see sort of the stability which is starting to exist in both of them, they have to be taken seriously. Absolutely.
Mm. They're a very streetwise team as well. I saw them on Saturday.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And very, you know, they know how to manage a game. They're very clever. And how they break up the pattern of the opposition's play. You know, it's... I think they've got a lot of nous, and I think that's really important and will be... You know, because there's a lot of teams who are... I mean, Fulham, for example... Fulham just look naive in the extreme, you know. But you know, when you look at the organisation and the way they'll squeeze games and kill games and wait for the right moment to break, I think that's important. The thing about Wolves is obviously in the background. There's Jorge Mendes
and Moutinho for £5 million, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Exactly. And so that gives them a huge advantage going forward. Yeah. You know. I think there's the likes of Arsenal and United, unless they get their act together, and Chelsea should be very, very scared of Wolves. Don't think they'll be scared of Watford as good and as streetwise they are, but Watford will take points off people left, right and centre, and they're still...
Mm. And you know, let's look at Nuno as well as a coach and a manager. He improves players.
Oh, really?
You know, you look at the way... Connor Cody, for instance, has improved so much that people did say, well, why wasn't he in the England squad?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd add Willy Boley in there as well, like a player that came out of the second division in France. He just looks like, he really looks like a £30 million centre half. He's been terrific. And the left side of fullback, Johnny, he's great too. I think he's one of the most underappreciated managers in the country, because with Wolves, you have Mendes, you have the Chinese money, and so you have the assumption that it's a kind of a blunt force trauma kind of success. It's not the case at all. They're a fabulously well-constructed side.
Well, you look at Doherty, you know he's...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
he's been exceptional this
Jota
year.
As well. Like, yeah. This is a team full of good players, but a team full of good players who fit together really nicely, especially at home. They're a real spectacle. When they're on form, when they actually hit the top gear, they're a great side to watch.
Well, the first time I saw them, I thought, you know, I'd heard so much about Martino and Neves, and I thought they were going to be flair players who were getting forward all the time.
Functionality to them.
They sat real deep until they got control of the game, and then they started getting forward. Brilliant.
Mm. There's a question from Brian, one of the listeners. Why does the FA continue to get it wrong with the FA Cup? VAR in use in some quarterfinals and not in others, thus creating inconsistencies at key stages of the tournament. Got it right, hasn't he?
Yeah, I don't have anything to add. Good point, Brian. I mean,
why don't we just stop the question as, why do the FA get it wrong?
Yeah. You've got 30 seconds to tell us.
Because the... I'd swear they're not very bright. I think they don't think through the consequences of some of their actions.
I thought it was very strange to say that you weren't going to have VAR at Swansea because it's not a Premier League club. Well, hang on.
Mike, also, this is how does no one see that coming, that problem? Because all it takes is a slight controversy in one of these games and then this conversation starts. I have no explanation for that. It's very, very strange.
Right. One thing the FA have done well with is the England team and the reconnection with the public. You know, you look on Friday, sellout at Wembley for the Czech Republic in the Euro qualifier. Can that be sustained, the feel-good factor?
Well, certainly with the players they've got, I think it can. I think there's so much ability there. I think there is... lots of young players who have the chance to grow and develop. For me, the biggest question is, can Southgate take them forward? Has he got the tactical nous rather than the man management? Because clearly he's got the man management, but has he got the tactical nous to turn this group into World Cup winners? I mean, you know, it's You know how I felt about them. I've been saying I'd take that squad to the semi-finals. Yeah. I think going to the semi-finals, in fact, maybe slightly underachieved because they didn't play that well and he didn't get all the different components in the right blend. But I think if I was an England fan, I would be very, very optimistic about the future.
Excused as well?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Mike, the depth of talent in those youth squads is extraordinary. I mean, in some positions, it's a little bit stockpiled. Perhaps it could do with a bit more of a broad spread. But the level of ability is unlike anything I've seen in my lifetime from an England setup as a whole.
Mm. Well, if you look at that under-21 squad, who's going to come through from that? You've got Callum Hudson-Odoi, who I thought made a big impact when he came on for Chelsea yesterday. Phil Foden. I think I saw Aaron Wan-Bissaka on Saturday, and I just thought, wow, you know, this is a player.
Angus Gunn as well. I mean, he's a really fine goalkeeper. Yeah,
and James Maddison, who really deserved probably in the senior squad.
I'm surprised he never got in this squad, Maddison. I'd like to see him play with Harry Kane and, tell Harry not to drop deep, get into the box and let Maddison work around behind him.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the only thing I could say, the only explanation I could offer probably is that the under-21s have a European Championship in 3 months. And I suspect Eddie Boothroyd wants to keep his squad intact. And someone like Maddison, I'm with Tony, I'd love to see him in England shirt, but I think at the moment he's saying, right, well, this guy is not going to be a default starter for a senior. Let's keep him in the under-21s until that cycle is over and then let him go. That's probably why James Ward-Prowse has been called up this morning, Monday. So, yeah, there's a bit of that. I just think it's fascinating. It's kind of... Even below someone like James Maddison, you've got a Mason Mount playing at Derby. I know he's been injured recently, but he's a fabulous footballer. Mm. And he's just full of these guys. Declan Rice is in now, and he's the kind of midfielder we haven't had probably for 20 years. Someone that can actually play at the base of midfield, not just stop and destroy and tackle. Mm. It's just a great time. I mean,
he already has a look of an 80-cap player to me.
Yeah. He's very talented. And that was, I mean, probably the area where Southgate struggled most. Yeah. You look at Eric Dyer hasn't kicked on like I thought he would, and Dyer and Henderson, it's a bit.
It's very it's flat.
Yeah, lacks imagination. Passive. Both of them are good players in their own way, and when Henderson's got the work rate and the adds a bit of vigour to it, but you need a little bit of vision, a little bit of imagination, and that's where he could give.
In that World Cup, Tony, when we got to the semi-finals, and that team came up against Rakitic and Modric, just sat there thinking, that's the problem. That's what we don't have. We can have these forwards, we have good centre-halves and full-backs and wingers. We don't have those players that will take a risk with the ball and cut lines with it. Mm.
It's almost imperceptible, but players are actually beginning to accumulate really good international careers.
Yeah.
Take Sterling as an example. 47 caps now. Only Henderson has got one more, has got more than him in the squad. Now, if his career runs its course, he could end up with about 120, 130 caps, couldn't he?
Yeah, easily, and you think of how many of those caps he's been appreciated. Very few of them. But hopefully if he stays fit, he should get a ridiculous number of caps because he's one of the main threats that England can produce. I mean, the fact is, even during the World Cup, and this is where one of my problems with Southgate substituted them. England lost the way because it allowed the opposition, who were having to account for Steele, and even if he didn't seem to be having a great game, they were having to double up on him. It allowed them to release a midfielder, and it allowed them to get control and get on top, and it happens all the time. I mean, Steele and terrifies defenders, and so I think... Yeah, he will be crucial if England are going to go and win the World Cup.
Right. Long way out. We've agreed that England's future is bright. How bright? Can they win the World Cup in 2022?
I could take them to the final.
Okay.
I think they will win the World Cup in 2026. I think they'll be very, very competitive in 2022. I don't have as much faith in my own managerial ability as Tony does. But, yeah, they'll be a level above where they were to 2018, of course.
That's not faith in my ability. It's faith in them. And you know what? And the thing is, you'd have to ask questions of the manager if he doesn't take
it. Yeah, I'd agree with that, absolutely.
Well, I, along with many others, took the mickey out of the FA's digital clock counting down to the 2022 World Cup final. Could England be in it? It's not that far-fetched. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.